Hello and welcome to Hear Her, the podcast of UNFPA East and Southern Africa. With the global population recently reaching 8 billion, we can celebrate many signs of human progress. Yet a sobering reality is how uneven progress has been and how systematically violence against women and girls still robs so many of dignity, well-being and the right to peace. In this podcast, you will hear voices from all walks of life with a common vision of building a more just, equitable, and sustainable future we all desire. Their voices matter, and it is the heart of all we do at UNFPA as we adapt to a changing world.
So, Maria, let's start off with you. Tell me, first of all, what is CSC about, and why is it important to the UNFPA's mandate?
Well, comprehensive sexuality education is a curriculum-based process of teaching and learning that deals with all aspects of sexuality, sexual reproductive health. You know, I could give you a very technical definition. It looks at what we learn cognitively, emotionally, physically, and social aspects. And it's gone by different names over the years. But it covers a full range of topics related to rights and gender without omitting challenging or sensitive topics when it's done, you know, to the international standards. And what's really important to reiterate here is that the qualities of effective CSC means that it's scientifically accurate, that it happens over time in age and developmentally appropriate ways. So you wouldn't teach the same thing to, you know, a 10-year-old that you're teaching to an 18-year-old or a 20-year-old. And that it's based, again, with human rights principles and gender equality in mind. In fact, gender transformation, so that we have the social norms eventually that are conducive to the best possible health and well-being for young people. And another important aspect is that it's culturally relevant and context appropriate. We could have a whole conversation around what that means, and that it's transformative in the lives of young people because it includes life skills. And one great thing that a lot of people don't really think about when you talk about CSC is that when you learn life skills, such as the full range of communication skills, decision-making skills, negotiation skills, critical thinking skills, they serve you in all aspects of life, not just in your sexual and reproductive health life. So those are some of the qualities of CSC. And this fits right into our mandate because, of course, we're looking to prevent maternal deaths, preventable maternal deaths. We're trying to get to, you know, zero people that have unmet need for family planning. We're trying to end gender-based violence and harmful practices. And in this region in particular, trying to prevent HIV and other sexually transmitted infections. So CSC is absolutely the foundational mechanism in which to get to all those transformative results I just mentioned for UNFPA. Okay. So, and we support governments in their efforts to do such a thing. So, you know, we have with us here a very esteemed colleague that I've been working with for many years from the Ministry of Youth in Malawi, who has been on this journey with UNFPA for several years on implementing in and out of school CSC through government and civil society partnerships. Over to you, Deus. What does CSC look like in the context of Malawi, and how is it important, and who is supporting it, and, you know, what is it looking like?
Malawi is one of the countries who were at the forefront in pioneering the curriculum, especially for out-of-school CSC in its current form. We started this journey, especially with the partnership and leadership of UNFPA in providing the technical as well as the financial support in rolling out the curriculum in country as, again, in collaboration with our neighboring countries. What CSC does, it basically responds and also aligns to the government priorities, especially when you look at the critical issues that Malawi is facing as a country, when it comes to issues of high rates for child marriages, the various harmful cultural practices, rising cases of adolescent pregnancies. You already mentioned about high incidences of HIV and STIs, sexual and gender-based violence, even issues of alcohol and drug abuse among adolescents and young people. And what CSC as a curriculum does is not just provide information, but also equip young people to critically think, to challenge some of these existing value systems that are quite harmful, but also at the same time, provide them with skills that will enable them to adopt various preventive behaviors. And as such, the alignment of the efforts by government to address these sexual and reproductive health issues among the population, we are utilizing CSC as a vehicle to provide not just information, but to equip young people so that they are able to protect themselves. And within this journey, we started us as a ministry in collaboration with our sister institutions, Ministry of Health most critically, but also have a number of other organizations. As I said, for us, our focus is on the out-of-school CSC, but also have Ministry of Education, who have the in-school curriculum, and it is being provided both at primary but also secondary level. Our package really comes in to complement what the in-school curriculum does, because what we have seen, there are still a number of gaps that, according to the prevailing policies, us as out-of-school, we may need to come in, especially when you want to link CSC to access to health services, which may not be straightforward between schools and health facilities. So, in essence, during this process, the rolling out and implementation of out-of-school CSC, we have seen more partnerships building, especially with civil society organizations. And we have also seen us partnering a little bit more strongly with faith institutions, where we were also asked to provide technical support when they were developing their own contextualized CSC package, but from a faith perspective, where now they linked the issues that we're talking about to verses probably in the Bible or in the Quran. And it just shows the building and strengthening of partnerships that we have in country. We are not there yet, but the journey moving forward is quite promising.
Maria, do you find that there's quite a disparity in the way that the different government departments in different countries actually handle this? I'm sure that there's some countries where it's falling down slightly. And how is the UN actually helping with this and helping through CSE to get young people to gain agency over their bodies and their futures?
Yeah, that's a great question. No country, no government, no body of people all have the same value system. So, you know, even within a government, there are different departments, different professionals with different belief systems. So there's no unified. I mean, most countries in the region have endorsed many of the policies and strategies that aim to reduce these sexual and reproductive health challenges that we have. Sometimes there are external forces that come in and try to mess with that and come in with an agenda that does not align with the rights of young people. So UNFPA with civil society, and I encourage Levi to speak next about what civil society has brought to this conversation, is just reminding governments, number one, what their priorities are, like Deus mentioned, and number two, really underscore that young people have the right to information and services. I mean, it always baffles me that after so many years and lessons learned, why shouldn't a 10-year-old girl learn about her body and know that menstruation is coming so she's not traumatized or knows what to expect and is prepared? You would not throw your child in the middle of the ocean without teaching them how to swim first. So why on earth do we do that in the area of sexual and reproductive health and rights? And so whenever there's been some kind of pushback or opposition movements, it has been young people and civil society that have really led the charge. And so, you know, Levi, please do share your experiences on this matter.
I think you and Juice have painted an incredibly useful picture in terms of the happenings around CSC within our region and the progress that has been made, but also in terms of the gaps that still remain in terms of achieving universal access to CSC for every adolescent and young person in Eastern Southern Africa. So it's quite simple. From a civil society perspective and from a youth civil society perspective, it's really clear that the communities and the beneficiaries of our program really do want information, education, knowledge, and access to services when it comes to SRHR. Young people across the region tell us that they want to be empowered, and empowerment means that they know about their bodies, they are aware of their choices, they have an understanding of their rights and the options that are available to them within their respective countries and within the region. Young people continue to tell us that they want to live free from violence, they want to live free from discrimination and from stigma of any sort and any kind. Young people also want to be able to communicate clearly with their peers and their communities across generations. So really talking about the competencies and the life skills that are related to good quality CSC. And lastly, young people again want to have the life skills and competencies which allow them to think critically about their lives and their futures and their proximity to their peers and positionality in societies, as well as how these competencies link to them becoming lifelong learners. So if I have to paint a picture, young people are telling us that they, again, want to be empowered, they want to have access to information, education, and health services, and they view CSC as a means of or a vehicle to attaining those aspirations for themselves and their communities and their peers.
Well, from there, let's ask Greta Biele, because as a young person, I mean, has CSC influenced your decision-making about your health? And how have you found it with other people in your country with you? Do you all have the same views? Are you finding this quite useful?
One of the concepts that CSE teaches us is bodily autonomy, which is about having absolute control over your body and is determined by one who makes decisions over your health. Can you say no to sexual intercourse, and when or whether or with whom do you want to have, do you want to become pregnant? So CSE has pushed me to be more autonomous and be more involved in decisions that affect me and my health. I can boldly say no to sex when my boyfriend wants us to have sex, and I feel absolutely not guilty about that because I'm autonomous about my body and my health. I can initiate condoms and contraceptives without fear, but above all, I can decide when and with whom do I want to have children with, because CSE, as far as bodily autonomy is concerned, has taught me about that. It is a shame that only 55% of women in the world have control over their bodies. But with more teachings from comprehensive sexuality education, the remaining 45% will have some control over their bodies. And through my advocacy on sexual and reproductive health rights, I've noticed that many young people, especially girls, are still lacking the knowledge thereof due to cultural norms that women must be submissive. But that submission costs them their lives literally and become victims of unintended pregnancies, HIV, as well as gender-based violence, especially intimate partner violence, because the norm around the society is that, well, if your partner beats you up, then he loves you, but that's not the case. They don't love you at all. However, some young people are pro comprehensive sexuality education and do not only appreciate its concepts, but also practice them. through my posts, as I am a social media influencer, they get to learn about what they can do if they find themselves in situations like intimate partner violence, where they can go to the police and file an assault case on their partners. So comprehensive sexuality education is very, very important.
Okay, so I'd also like to know, just from the point of view of the first stop for many young people to find out about these things is obviously their parents. And especially before there were things like social media or internet, you'd either get your information from your friends or from your parents. Because the schools generally wouldn't be putting out that much. The government wasn't really focused on educating younger people about sexuality because it was something that wasn't spoken about. With all of the new ways of getting information, are you comfortable in talking to your parents about sex? I mean, do younger people still talk to their parents about sex and sexuality? Or is it an uncomfortable conversation for younger people to have?
Where I come from, Lesotho is a very cultural, stereotypical country wherein sex is deemed as a taboo. So some young people still find it hard to talk to their parents about sex. I learned about sex on social media and through my friends. I never had the opportunity to talk to my parents about sex. But as years went by, she grew more comfortable with me and we started talking about sex. But there's still a great portion of people who cannot talk to their parents about sex because their parents themselves were never taught about sex and they still deem it as a stereotypical issue. So many, many people, especially in cultural dominated countries and societies, they find it hard to talk to their parents about sex. So they resort to platforms like social media to learn about sex and also their friends. And that can be very misleading because where do they get this information? How accurate is it? And does it encourage healthy practices?
And Levi, for you, do you find the same thing where you are? Do you have any qualms about speaking to your parents about sexual matters?
I would say that there is still the generational divide when it comes to talking about issues around sex and sexuality. In most communities, and I would say the community that I come from is not exempt from those sort of conversations. However, what we are seeing, especially as we look at trends within our region, as digital and mobile penetration expands across our region, more and more young people are turning to digital and new media to access information and knowledge about sex and sexuality, but they're also looking to peer networks that are being formed online to really get information and knowledge. And I think that we have an exponential opportunity here to really look at providing CSC out of school and out of, you know, a rigid, formalized curricular base through online platforms and through digital options. And yes, I understand that the digital divide is a thing, but from what we're seeing, according to data from a variety of statistical agencies across the region, the digital divide is gradually and incrementally shrinking. And again, more and more young people, especially in urban and urban informal environments, are turning to new and digital media for information. I think we really have to consider catalyzing that space. And UNFPA have already done some great work, so has other UN agencies and the UN family across the board, in terms of really looking at how digital platforms can be leveraged to link young people to information and knowledge, but also to health services broadly. So maybe Maria would like to talk a bit about some of UNFPA's interventions around there, or Juice could maybe talk about the Safeguard Young People's Program, which has really been linked to other incredible initiatives like TUNY, for instance. But I'll just throw that out there for now. Thanks.
Yeah, just to reiterate some of what Levi said is that young people get information from a variety of sources, and not all of those sources come with the same type of information. Some are factual, some are kind of moralistic, some are incorrect altogether, some are misleading. And so really, young people are growing up with conflicting messages. And so CSE, whether it's in a formal educational curriculum or out of school in community-based programs or online, it's the quality of the information and that they have those qualities that we mentioned, that they're accurate. So we want to put together collectively with young people really helping us in the design of this information, putting out good sources of information. And parents the world over find it difficult to talk directly to their young people about sexuality issues. But, you know, it is changing over time, even in very culturally sensitive areas. And even that is relative, because not talking about sexuality is a message that somehow it's bad or wrong, or a point of where we shouldn't talk about it between a parent and a child. And yet there's all these other confusing messages. So we do have data from the region that say anytime you engage parents, your overall CSE programs will be better off. The minute a parent can start talking about the value of a condom, if and when their child is ready to use a condom, and that's a whole other conversation, but if a child knows that the parent has kind of pro-condom views, condom use increases for those young people. So there's a more communication between young people and their parents. So we do have some evidence that's going in that direction. And, you know, there's another big myth that parents are against CSE or cultural leaders or religious leaders. And it's not really true at all. It's just that sometimes it's the people who oppose or don't understand make more noise. But when stakeholders, parents, religious leaders, community leaders, various segments of society, when they learn about the value of CSE and the benefits of CSE, then they come around and understand and demystify what it is that they think it is. So that's a very important message to put across as well.
So, Deus, how is CSE implemented in and out of school in Malawi, in your country? How do you think it should be actually rolled out in most countries?
First and foremost, for the in-school CSE, as I said, it's delivered especially in primary and secondary schools across all classes. For primary, it's a mandatory subject. So each and every pupil or student has to go through that subject, but it's delivered through the life skills subject itself. At secondary school, it's again an elective subject, because they can either take it or not, because I think at secondary school level, there are a number of subjects where students are at liberty to choose what kind of subjects they are supposed to take. But I should emphasize that it is examinable, and it is it has undergone through the review in terms of the curricula itself. I think now they are also undertaking another review in terms of aligning it to emerging issues and the current standards that we have. For out of school, which is basically my space and my domain, we have the curriculum, which has a number of packages, which again, I may spend a whole day in terms of unbundling what that package is all about. But what we use mainly are trained facilitators. So we have youth facilitators in the communities that provide CSE content within established platforms like youth clubs, organizations, youth-friendly services corners, or in health service delivery points, or within their own community-level groups, such as community-based organizations, etc. That is our primary methodology in terms of delivery of CSE. And that's the most traditional methodology. But also at times use specialized individuals, for example, special needs teachers, if we want to deliver CSE to young people with disabilities. If we want to deliver CSE to young people living with HIV, we go through their own platforms and structures to deliver the customized packages to them. We also utilize the digital and online platforms to provide information In Malawi, we have what we call the Chunmi platform. It's a mobi site where all these issues around sexuality, about daily experiences of young people are discussed, are disseminated. Young people themselves have been using some platforms such as WhatsApp messaging app. We have had Facebook pages. Now, in partnership with Maria, the regional office, what we have done is to translate short video clips into local languages, and those are used and shared to young people through various online platforms. So our package, especially for the out-of-school one, it is quite customizable in such a way that we try to reach different categories of young people through different media, both the traditional as well as the non-traditional methodologies. But moving forward, what we'd like to see is a little bit of scaling up in terms of how we reach young people, because the current methodologies really require a little bit of heavier investment in terms of building the capacities of facilitators, checking the quality of information, even providing the actual information to them as a package of service. That requires a little bit of resourcing. So it's an area that we are trying to see in terms of how else can we also scale up and upscale the delivery of CSE, probably using non-traditional methodologies so that we are able to utilize the small resources that we have to the maximum. But again, we're trying to explore ways and means in terms of how we'll integrate CSE into some already existing programs outside the entire SRHR programming. So for example, in Malawi, we have a new program around National Youth Service. So it's basically a program that wants to activate and equip young people, providing them with necessary skills for them to be productive economically, socially, also providing community service within their communities to address some of the issues that they can on their own, and want to try to integrate CSE within this component as a cross-cutting issue, both as a service to young people, but also to coin provision of CSE as a service to their communities, but also at the same time, the young people are accessing CSE as information package that want to upscale. So we're trying to find ways and means in terms of what kind of programs we already have so that we integrate CSE and at least we'll be able to reach more corners in country.
Maria, we've got a few things that are going on here. Firstly, in some societies, sex and talking about sex is pretty much taboo. On the other hand, you have people who don't know who to speak to, so they speak to their peers and they're getting misinformation. Throw into the mix the fact that you have adolescents who don't feel comfortable being in the same room with members of the opposite sex and talking about sex when they're quite young as well. But there's the biggest problem, I think, is that a lot of people believe this myth that talking about sex or being aware of what's happening around the sexual arena leads to early sexual movements with young people, that they're going to go out and do it instead of actually just thinking about it. Do you find that that is a myth, and is that thinking prevalent throughout the continent?
It is absolutely a myth that learning about sexuality, learning about your body and how to protect your own sexual reproductive health, learning about healthy relationships and recognizing when they are unhealthy, does not make young people run out and have sex. In actual fact, the evidence over decades demonstrates that having age-appropriate, scientifically accurate, good quality sexuality education delays the age in which young people have sex for the first time. So it is actually the opposite. And not only do they delay the age because they'll know the consequences, but the evidence continues to say that they decrease the number of sexual partners and frequency of sex so that every act of sexual intercourse is more intentional. And that increases the use of contraception, especially condoms, reduces misinformation, and increases correct knowledge about sexuality, relationships, and all of the issues. And when we talk about sexuality education, not only is it giving the factual information, but it's trying to create spaces and facilitate the development of health-promoting attitudes. So attitudes that are pro going to sexual or reproductive health facilities to access services, and actually the behaviors of getting to those services. And we heard about, you know, how CSC inspires young people to go for, you know, services related to gender-based violence if that is something that they're facing. But ultimately, the biggest value of sexuality education is that not only can it reach large numbers of young people in and out of school through a variety of modes and modalities, whether it's traditional or digital, and speaks to all those issues around scaling up and geographically saturating and institutionalizing CSE, but it's really about the prevention, that it imparts this information, the life skills, the attitudes and behaviors at very strategic moments in time. So you don't want to talk about puberty to 18-year-olds. That's way too late. You have to give the right information in the right way at the right time so that the young people are developing and maintaining healthy behaviors, in contrast to the need to create behavior change. And that's a big shift that we advocate for. Wouldn't it be nice that our young people choose when and with who and the conditions in which they have sexual relationships? And not all sexual relationships means intercourse, right? It can be expressing one's sexuality in a variety of ways, and be prepared for all the consequences. The world doesn't have to judge them for it, you know? And then therefore, if you have a more balanced view of sexuality and sexuality education, we will get better benefits, more health-promoting, health-seeking behaviors. And we will see those rates of HIV, gender-based violence, unintended pregnancies go down. But we just have to give CSE the chance. We have to link CSE to services and commodities. We just need to let CSE have that chance to follow through on all these theoretical and evidence-based promises. But, you know, we need to stay the course, and we need young people to lead the charge.
As Retta Bile is actually doing. So, Retta Bile, what source of information have you found for yourself to be the most beneficial? And what have you seen to be the most beneficial to other people that you've been working with?
Okay, so the one that gets easier and better for them are the comprehensive sexuality education programs, both in and out of school. And for me, I've received it in school while I was in primary school and also high school. So the kind of information that I got was age appropriate, and we got that information in a formal setting with different methods of approaches from our teachers. And the kind of information that I got was scientifically accurate. So as I grew older, like right now, I get information from UNFPA pages and other sexual and reproductive health rights pages, because they provide scientifically accurate information. That's the case with other young people who are not fortunate enough to be in school, because they get this information from community-based programs for out-of-school people, where they can learn about sex and sexuality, measures they should take, and how they can protect themselves during and after sex.
And Levi, do you find that the people who have actually gone through the program, do you think that they are a lot more empowered because of the fact that they know a little bit more? Do you think that they're empowered in the sexual and reproductive health rights as well?
Retta Bile has shared a good, you know, personal experience in terms of her own access to CSC and how that has resulted in her being able to make more empowered decisions and choices about her body and her life. So in South Africa, for instance, I would say that, the young people that I engage with and continue to engage with continue to talk about how even with the limited CSE that they tend to get in terms of the form of a one-hour lesson every 1 or 2 weeks, it's something that really does allow them room and a safe space for them to express themselves, but also to ask difficult questions in a safe space and difficult questions as it relates to conversations like consent, issues around sex and you know, safe sex at that. And then there's also conversations in the classroom, I think, that Maria touched on in terms of violence and preventing violence and how so much of the violence that we tend to see is deeply embedded in social norms and in how, you know, adolescents are treated as children and how children who are exposed to violence in childhood tend to manifest that into adolescence and into adulthood. So really, the CSE provision has really allowed space for conversation. It's allowed space for reflection. And to an extent, it's given confidence, competencies, and life skills to young people to navigate the further probing of many of these issues and many of these difficult conversations as they continue to develop. And hopefully, in many cases, it's linked young people to age-appropriate and scientifically accurate information that allows them to make more informed decisions about their health, their bodies, and their lives. And that's the experience that we tend to be getting off the ground from young people who are beneficiaries and partners of our program and our work.
We've got young people who are very keen to know more about it. Now, Deus, do you find that you've got pushback from, say, parents and community leaders when it comes to the implementation of CSE and also about what children are going to learn in these CSE sessions?
Yes, Melanie. I'll answer this question twofold. From experience, yes, we have been meeting pushbacks, resistance from various players within society, but usually it has been more from an individual basis in terms of not resisting or pushing back, but there have been fears in terms of what the content is all about, what exactly are we teaching the young people about, because there have been misconceptions and myths about CSE as a field of implementation. And we have been engaging different gatekeepers as well as community leaders to explain a bit more what CSE is all about, providing the kind of illumination of what is contained in the package itself. So that has really assisted us to go and penetrate and engage young people within their own communities. But recently, we have also observed that now there's more organized kind of resistance to CSE, probably influenced by external forces. We have seen articles coming out in newspapers, in various publications online, really against provision of CSE, both in school but also within out-of-school spaces. And at times, yes, we may be tempted to react and respond promptly, but we have taken a more accommodative and a more sober approach in terms of engaging and providing the information to those that are providing this kind of organized resistance. So yes, resistance and pushbacks are there, but also have mechanisms in terms of how we address them, how we engage, rather than creating a standoff where it benefits no one, especially the young people who are in dire need for this particular information. And I know Maria can also agree with me in terms of even in other countries, especially in the southern part of Africa, where we have these kinds of experiences working with the various gatekeepers, especially the local religious and traditional leaders.
No, absolutely. You know, I've been working on the continent for about 30 years, and I always find it very interesting to see this kind of cultural you know, whose culture are we talking about? You know, when you look at the colonial history, how some of the laws and policies are hangovers from that time, and how that interacts with local, indigenous, traditional cultures, some of which are harmful, but some of which are very positive in the upbringing of the development of young people and the value systems. So it's always interesting. And I find rural communities in particular to be more progressive, not less progressive, because when a teenage girl gets pregnant in town, you know, it's not uncommon for her to be sent home to her rural village to deliver that baby and raise that baby. Or when deaths around HIV were so commonplace, it's those bodies were brought home to rural areas to be buried. So the rural areas, the traditional structures, are experiencing the consequences much more intimately than kind of us bureaucrats and technocrats and policymakers in the big cities. So I think that the partnerships are so important between young people, civil society, all these traditional structures and, you know, indigenous knowledge and all these different threads to come together, even with opposing the opposition forces. At the end of the day, we all want what's best for our children. How do we find a common narrative for the greater good? I think that's what, you know, Retabile, Levi, Deus, and I, we all are working towards. How can we all come together and work for and with young people so that we don't have to talk about these crazy rates of teen pregnancy, and that we have a much more optimistic set of results to talk about, and how all of this links to overall development. I mean, you asked about earlier about how the United Nations and governments and civil society all come together and why we do it. We want to develop the nations of this part of the world to the maximum, to be the economic empowerment of young people and having all of the great things that we're all striving for. So you don't have wealth without health. So, you know, having young people be sexually healthy and completing basic schooling and being in healthy relationships and being able to take care of the families that they produce and educate the next generation. I mean, these are all fundamental steps in the development of the nations of East and Southern Africa. You know, I just would like to end our conversation with the idea that young people, we want to hear more from you. What can we do to do better? What can we, how can we help make sure that we don't, you know, those policymakers that get worried about the opposing forces, you know, how do we strengthen and deeply root our efforts around sexuality education so that you do get the information and the services you need for your futures? So, I mean, I really want to hear more from young people about what can be done and how we can partner more efficiently.
Before responding to, you know, what young people want and how young people view themselves as partners, I'd like to go into slightly more detail with the liberties of coming from a civil society organization that's been working in the opposition monitoring space. And I think it's worth highlighting to the listeners that most of the opposition that we're seeing is either Washington funded or Eastern European funded. So when Maria raises the question of whose values is being projected onto us, it's worth following the money, and the money mainly funding opposition to SRHR, to youth rights, to work around women's rights on the continent is really coming from outside the continent, number one. Number two, it's also worth the audience familiarizing themselves with the facts that remain at a political level. So fundamentally, there are a number of progressive political consensus on adolescent and youth SRHR, and on comprehensive sexuality education. And I think the most progressive one that one could put a finger to is the Addis Ababa Declaration on Population and Development, which explicitly speaks to the rights that adolescents have to access information, education, knowledge, and SRH services. It talks explicitly about the unique needs of adolescents and young people as it relates to sexual, reproductive, and health rights. And it was framing this conversation as early as 2014. So even before the Sustainable Development Goals were agreed to or Agenda 2063 was finalized, you had a hard-fought consensus on adolescent and youth SRHR globally and within the continent of Africa. And that's something that must be appreciated, but beyond appreciation, it's something that as young people we need to be aware of and something that we should be willing to defend when questioned if, you know, SRHR or CSE is being imposed on us by Europeans or other progressive groupings internationally. The last thing I'd say on the issue of, you know, youth leadership and intergenerational partnerships. Yes, young people do want to partner. Young people do want to be mentored and young people do want to have their voices amplified by intergenerational allies. But at the same time, youth-led and youth-serving organizations do need resources. Youth-led and youth-serving organizations need to be viewed as equal partners by the development architecture. And I think there's a lot more conversation to be had around how youth-led and youth-serving organizations will basically form the vanguard to defend rights into the future. And I'm not even just talking about SRHR, I'm talking about the fight for gender equality on the continent, the fight for climate justice, the fight for tax justice, and again, through that lens of intersectionality, I think is the only way forward. But fundamentally, it really comes down to how influence, power, and resources are being brokered and being negotiated between intergenerational allies and youth-led and youth-serving organizations, which are going to be at the center of fighting for social justice and social change and transformation into the future.
Okay, well, talking about influencing, Greta Bile, I mean, you obviously have a fair amount of influence in what you're doing. What would you like to see change, or what do you think that either the UN or schools or governments could be doing better or differently?
Young people need to play an active role in building support for comprehensive sexuality education. Student councils, youth groups, and individual youth leaders should be actively encouraged to provide input on the design, the monitoring, and evaluation of comprehensive sexuality education programs. They must collect information about their peers' needs to develop the justification for comprehensive sexuality education and initiate dialogues with parents and other gatekeepers in the community about the importance of comprehensive sexuality education.
So the other important thing for sexuality education to engage with is it creates platforms for young people. And so we're using these platforms to bring in other mega trends such as climate change. In fact, there are connections between how climate change impacts or links to sexual reproductive health and rights. For example, if there's a climate disaster, schools close down and access to CSE becomes limited, but also young people cannot access services like the commodities or go to the services. We know when there's climate disasters and people are on the move and there's a state of flux, gender-based violence increases, maternal health is affected. So CSE becomes a natural platform in which to embed these messages. And so UNFPA has created a curriculum, first of its kind, called Resilient Futures. And it does look at the links between climate change and sexual reproductive health and what young people can do to mitigate or to understand and engage with these inevitable situations we're going to increasingly find ourselves in. So you know, this whole idea, whether it's climate change or access to CSE more generally, how can young people hold their governments accountable to their commitments? What can young people do locally to mitigate climate change, to get to sexual and reproductive health services, to get the information they need, whatever come what may? And we did learn lessons from COVID-19 as well.
Just one point on external shocks and another point on accountability. So on the external shocks, I think Maria's done a great job to highlight the linkage between integrating climate change and climate resilience into CSE programming. However, I think another external shock, which young people in our region are probably incredibly aware of, are the economic fallouts that our respective economies are experiencing post-pandemic. Most of our economies find themselves in a situation of debt distress, and some of the recent data is telling us that we currently are seeing governments spending more money on servicing debt than they are spending on health and education systems combined. So that's really quite telling in terms of the precarious economic situation that we find ourselves in as countries. So it's really around the next point in terms of accountability. So young people might want to know that there is a window of opportunity to really work around accountability for CSC and their SRHR, with governments reporting on SDG progress in the next year, in 2023 to 2024. But then further to that, there is the ICPDF 30 momentum. So the International Conference on Population Development is in its 30th year. And member states have been invited, or countries rather, have been invited to really share progress on you know, what's moved or what's been learned over the last 5 years, but also to talk more openly around the gaps and the challenges that have been experienced over the last 5 years in terms of programming. Countries are expected to develop reports. There are supposed to be national consultations involving civil society and young people. And I know in the next few days, some of the civil society actors, at least in Eastern Southern Africa, will be putting out some information with regards to how civil society and their diversity and youth and need-serving organizations in particular can participate in some of these national stakeholder consultations. And we're happy to link young people who might be in the audience to some of these processes so that their voices can be heard and that they can be at the table when some of these emerging issues of interest are being discussed.
For us as a country, Malawi has experienced a number of natural disasters, especially cyclones in the past 3-4 years. And especially last year, there was another cyclone. It was quite devastating. And this year as well, we had Cyclone Freddy. That was also very devastating in a number of districts. So we partnered as a ministry with UNICEF to undertake an initiative around climate action, especially led by adolescent girls. But what we did, Maria talked about the CSE and climate change module, the separate one that we have. We utilize that as an entry point in terms of building the capacities of the adolescent girls and also illuminating to them and highlighting issues around how such disasters and climate change has a direct impact in terms of their livelihoods, as well as the conditions of their communities, etc. How they can build resilience and how the adolescent girls can be in the forefront in terms of climate actions within their own societies. And I should point out that afterwards they have gone and undertaken projects and interventions to address some of these issues at their own community level. And these are experiences that we are currently documenting and will be able to share a little bit more with other stakeholders. But I just wanted to highlight the importance of this particular module as an entry point, as a vehicle for engaging communities. And in this instance, it has helped us in terms of even bridging what we have with UNFPA into the actions that we're having with UNICEF. We can clearly see the importance of CSC, not just as an end, but also as a vehicle to link, but also to push us towards other interventions.
Okay, back to Maria. How do the UNFPA ensure that no young person is going to be left behind?
Well, this issue of leaving no one behind is taken very seriously because we know we cannot reach the Sustainable Development Goals and develop our nations in this part of the world with leaving anyone behind. Traditionally, young people are a group that gets left behind in many of the policies and strategies that affect them. And so do young people with disabilities, young people living with HIV, young people from diverse sexual orientations and identities, and the list goes on and on. The idea is that, number one, whatever happens in school is as inclusive as possible, and different countries have different legal systems that can limit what that means. But we also have to understand that half of Africa's young people are actually not in school. So the relevance of what the work that everyone is doing here out of school and in the community spaces takes on special significance in a context where half of young people are not in school, and that and among those that are not in school are the most vulnerable, the poorest of the poor families that can't afford to send their children to school, the young people with disabilities, and all of those kind of geographic or culturally very isolated communities, indigenous groups. So we are moving towards universal access to CSE. We're trying to bring the resources and the institutionalization. And that is why partnering with a Ministry of Youth, for example, or civil society organizations becomes so incredibly important to make sure that no young people are left behind. And you've also heard about how we're reaching young people not only in classrooms and in traditional face-to-face community-based settings, but also through the digital or kind of other innovative ways of reaching young people. So whether it be online or whether it be through apps, videos, mobi sites, whether it be finding places where young people gather. So that could also be religious organizations. It could be sports groups. You know, so we're trying to use multiple methods of reaching all the young people that absolutely deserve this information and absolutely deserve services. We also know that the whole concept of self-care becomes important. Self-care comprises of self-awareness, so that's the information that we're giving through CSE, but also there are lots of forms of sexual reproductive health care that one can consider taking charge of on their own if needed. So menstrual health, emergency contraception pills or other forms of contraception sometimes are available, you know, privately, HIV testing sometimes, testing for cervical cancer. You know, there's a lot of different methods now that we are trying to put out there to empower young people to get access to the information and services that they need. But the bottom line is we really do need to work towards universal access so that no young person is left behind.
And of course, the first point of access is always asking your parents. So Rita Bile, what is one thing that you wish you could have learnt in school or found out from your parents about sex? What would that one thing be?
That one thing would be the fact that menstruation, having your period does not mean you are sexually active. Because around my time, back in 2011, when I first had my period, the myth around that time was that once you have your period, it means that you are sexually active. So when I first had my period, I was so devastated and did not tell anyone until it got out of hand and had to tell my mom that, okay, so I've had my period, and then she had to get me some sanitary towels. So I wish I knew back then that menstruation does not mean that one is sexually active. I think what they were trying to protect us from back then is just that they couldn't say it out loud, is that once you have your period, it means you can be able to have children. So now that's where CSE comes in, teach children that if they have sexual not children, but teach young people that once they have sexual intercourse, they will fall pregnant. So I wish I just knew that it has nothing to do with sex, because I was devastated and prayed a lot that day that God, please take this away.
Levi, what was the one thing that you wish you had learned when you were younger?
So many things. I would say that menstruation shouldn't be stigmatized. I think reflecting on going to a very Orthodox Christian school, we're taught that menstruation is bad and menstruation means that girls are unclean, and that obviously bled into misconceptions and unequal power dynamics within school when one reflects. So yeah, just knowing the basics, menstrual health, menstruation 101 would have been really useful.
Okay, and Deus, did you find the same thing in your country?
Yes, I think personally, what I would have loved much, much more is, especially around communication when it comes to issues of sex, because I think personally I had to train myself to how, for example, I would demand something, to what limit I would go for something, for instance. Though that was a learning experience, that if probably I had a conversation with either a parent or a guardian or someone as an adult, probably I would have navigated those waters a little bit more smoothly. But I had to learn sometimes a hard way. And it's still a learning process in terms of communication, especially with the other sex partner or the loved one or a spouse. And as I said, it's still a learning curve, but I think I would have appreciated the foundational stage in terms of those kinds of skills and capabilities to be able to have more fond experiences, especially in my adolescent years.
And Maria, what was one of the things that you hear the most from young people when they're saying, oh, I wish I'd known that?
Oh, there's so many things. But what I think both personally and in doing this work for 30 years is that we keep having this dominant discourse that young people should say no to sex, that it is dangerous and risky. But wouldn't it be nice to be in a world where they feel empowered to say yes to sex, sexual relationships, pleasurable sex, if I may even say go that far, under the ideal conditions? And, you know, not every first incidence of sex is negative and doom and gloom, even for a young woman. An African young woman can have a positive first sexual experience. So perhaps we can learn more about those positive first experiences and the trajectories of a positive sex life and have that be the inspiration to other young people. I think that now that I'm a parent too, I think being a parent is one of the hardest jobs we'll ever have. And, you know, just to continue to remind myself, that I have so many opportunities to teach my young son about his body, about gender equality, about social norms where everybody can be happy and healthy and live in an equitable way. I think that most young people want to know more about the juicy and the relationship dynamics. They don't want to hear about only about the plumbing of menstruation and reproductive systems, which is important, very important. But they want to know about the emotional stuff. They want to know about relationships, you know, how to talk to a partner, like Dave said. And for young men in particular, you know, we expect them to know everything, but where are they going to learn it from? Women and girls have more opportunities to get information from the health sector because we menstruate, because we have maternal health care and other reproductive health issues. It's more acceptable that we access services. But where do young men get the information and services? I mean, it's already very stigmatized or taboo if a man goes to a clinic and it's something to do with sexual reproductive health, he's either going for an HIV test or treatment or you know, some STI thing. So how do we teach young men that asking the right questions is okay, accessing services is okay, how to make accessing a clinic, can we destigmatize it away from some of those things? Like, can we just make it a more hospitable space? Oh, I could go on that question. But really, like, the balance of what's good about sexual relationships is what really we need to hear more of. And that's in spite of or because of all the opposition that takes place. You get more flies with honey than with vinegar, as they say. I think we'll be more effective in our sexuality education when we really balance that sexuality is not inherently good or bad. It things shape it and shape our experiences, but you know, we have to come from a much more balanced place.
As a young person, well, I'm speaking on behalf of other young people, we would also like to learn about the fact that sex is supposed to be enjoyed, because the society has made it out to be something so bad and so evil. We'd like to know about, like, learning that it should be enjoyed, and it should be, we should know our bodies and how we can enjoy during sex, because it's not like, it's something that young people are doing. So I think people miss the part about the fact that people are supposed to enjoy it. They only focus on protection, on pregnancy, on other stuff surrounding sex, and forget the vital part that it should be enjoyed, and well, it should be intentional, of course.
So, Deus, how then do you make something like this not about the nuts and bolts, but actually about the emotion that goes into it? Because unfortunately, when you are learning about something, it is very much kind of going by rote. There are things that are written down, and that's how you put it across. How do you make it more emotionally accessible to young people?
I'll go back to my previous statement in terms of having the right people with the right information, with the right skills in terms of provision of CSE. So, for example, if we are using facilitators, or at times other institutions use peer educators, we should emphasize and we should invest heavily in capacitating them, because it is quite critical in terms of how they engage young people on the ground, how they provide this information. Because at the top level, in terms of development of the curriculum, of the material, we are very careful in terms of how we construct and craft the information as a package. But it is also very important in terms of how it is delivered on the ground. And as such, the people that we entrust to deliver the content on the ground, we need a lot of investment in terms of their ability to do that. We also need to do quite a lot in terms of quality assurance, because it's one thing to build the capacities and let them go to deliver the content. But are they doing it within the right context? Are we providing them with the right information and support for them to be able to do that? So it's an entire spectrum of programming that goes from the development of the materials itself up until the delivery. But there are a lot of pieces that we need to oversee and to ensure that it is being provided in a quality manner. As Maria, I think, said previously, it's one thing to deliver, but each and every community has different dimensions in terms of the issues that you meet. They might be small in nature, but then those have the capacity really to negatively impact on the program. So it's quite important that as delivery points, we capacitate especially the youth themselves, who are the leaders, especially in our country, in terms of delivery of CSE, to be able to navigate and engage young people and provide information in a more factual manner, instead of either coloring it or applying their own objective or subjective biases in this instance, and try to twist the key messages around CSE. And that is very, very critical, so that some of these other pushbacks and resistance that we have seen can also be lessened to an extent.
I definitely do agree with Juice's points, and I think the only elements that I might add to that is really considering how we build a shared narrative for adolescents and young people with adolescents and young people in our region. I think most of us can agree that we do want a healthy, empowered, and resilient generation of young people who can contribute towards economic growth and development, but also towards more just and peaceful societies. And at the base of that empowerment and that development is really how they navigate their sexual, reproductive, and health rights, how they manage their fertility, and how they are able to engage in respectful and consensual relationships amongst themselves. And I think it's really around building a shared narrative and a shared discourse that we can bring more people into believing. So not necessarily where we're trying to convince others with arguments and with facts, but rather building a shared narrative towards the shared goal for the development of our region, and most importantly for the empowerment and further development of our adolescents and young people in our region, I think would be my contribution. And I definitely think that you can't rely solely on law and policy for that. Take the case of South Africa. We've got the most liberal constitution in the entire world. We've got some of the most progressive laws when it comes to enabling SRHR, but we haven't really invested in the connection between that legislative and policy infrastructure and the building of social discourse and the shifting of social norms to get everyone moving in that direction, or at least the majority of people moving in that direction. And I think that's a potential lesson and case study for the rest of the region, to say that yes, you can have law and policy in place, but you have to invest in building a social discourse that others can rally around and walk a journey with you.
Anybody else got anything else they'd like to add?
Viva young people, viva, viva CSE, viva.
Viva.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.